I said, well, I told him, I was in his like meetings for him to go to high school, and I said, you're going to say the wrong thing to the wrong girl next year, and their boyfriend who doesn't know you and hasn't dealt with you for 3 years is going to beat the donkey stuff out of you. I said, I'm not saying, like, I'm just warning you that you've got to watch what you say.
And there's some girls that could take him out, too.
Yeah, well, the only reason one of them did it in my room is because I looked at her and I said, I need you to walk away, please. And she was like, if this was anybody else's girl, I wouldn't do it, but I'll do it for you.
Now, I got seventh grade girls this year that have been. I have not had this little one at all. I've been doing great.
Yeah.
And but the boys have been like monkeys.
Yeah.
Where's James? Is he giving up on our class? Not feeling good? Not feeling good?
It's a short drive.
Okay. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are in. Obviously not Travis. Travis was slated to teach today, and he got asked to preach in, was it Hodgenville, Liz? Yeah, that's what I thought so earlier. Hodgenville, so he's hanging out in Hodgenville today preaching. He said, hey, will you teach on Sunday, on Mother's Day? I was like, yeah, sure, I'll teach. And then I looked at the schedule, and I realized that makes me Sunday, Wednesday. So you get a triple dose of me. But he did say, hey, I've already made the slide, you can go ahead and do it. And I was like, that's great, because that's generally what takes me the longest, because I don't know if, as you prepare classes, like, different people have different styles. Like, Travis is about 9 lessons ahead, and I work about the week of. It's just, that's just, I like to do it that way, because it keeps it fresh in my brain. Otherwise, I'll start mixing up, I'll start talking about chapter 26 when we're still talking about 20, and it all goes nuts. So, but yeah, I don't know. That's one of the interesting things. Like, if you've ever taught a class, it's, you sort of learn how you do. I read the verses 2 or 3 times all the way through, just no interruptions, no note taking at that point. And then I go back and I do notes. And then you go back and I'll do a second set of notes, editing the notes I just took. And then I'll do my final one. I go through with this and my notes and I sit at the computer, usually 2 days before creating my slides and the stuff like that. And then the day of, I'll sit down with it again just to edit. So. It's interesting, sort of the process. That's something that always interests me. In how do people prepare a class? So now that I've admitted that I take forever on my lessons, I'm gonna do this. But what's funny is Stephen. If you ever had Stephen Ogden's class, he prepares his classes about 8 to 10 months ahead of time. Like, he knows exactly what he wants to say from the beginning, and it cracks me up because He asked me, are you prepared for Samuel? I was like, yeah, I've been reading through it a little bit. I've been doing this and this. And it was like the week before, he goes, you haven't started. I was like, I'm like, I'm good, man. But he's like, oh, I've ordered, he's got a stack of books. It's pretty funny.
You're the freak, dude. But
I will say, Stephen is one of my favorite people to sit in his class. His battery's a little low. Just because you don't ever know, where he's going to go with it. And there's so many connections. And that time, really, you can tell that the time is there. So, Joe, you mind starting us off with a prayer?
Sure.
Thanks.
Father in heaven, we thank you for this day and all the blessings you've given us. We thank you for this opportunity to come and study more from your book. And we ask that as Sean presents it, that we'll listen and have attentive hearts to this and we'll be able to dig into it and understand it better. We ask that we'll be able to make these connections to our lives to help us in our daily walk. I ask that you go with us and give us mercy. In Jesus' name, we pray.
So we are in 21 through 23 today. This is another one of those where it's like this little vignette that sort of keep coming up, and there's a little bit of connection here, and there's big questions that come up from where we talked about in the last few classes. And so, where were we at the end of 20? Who had just finished talking for close to the last time?
Jonathan.
Yeah, Jonathan and David, right? And they'd made a pact, and what did they agree to do?
Friends forever.
So they agreed to be friends, and not even just be friends, but also to look out for each other's houses, right? That they were going to honor each other's descendants, on and on and on. Because at this point, what does Jonathan know about his dad's reign?
It's coming to an end.
It's coming to an end, correct, and that he will not do this. And so he is 100% sure that Saul's going to die eventually. And who's going to become king?
David.
So does Jonathan, that's my question at first, is does Jonathan know that he is going to also die in the process of all of this? Yeah?
He may not know for sure, but a lot of times when a new family took over the kingdom, they killed the rest of the family from that previous king.
True.
So he knows it's a possibility.
So he knows it's a possibility, but does he know that he is? It's going to probably, it's going to be at the same time as Saul goes? Okay, yeah. So he's covering at least part of his bases by talking to David and being like, look, when you're the king, I'm all for it. I'm here for you, right? You don't have to worry about me. I know that you're God's anointed. We talked a little bit on Wednesday night. I sort of see Jonathan and his responses. He's sort of pragmatic, but he's sort of a Pollyanna, right? Everything's good. Everything's happy. He wants to believe everybody is... going to do the best thing. Oh, my dad doesn't want to kill you. He's sure everything's fine, even though he literally said he wanted to kill you. No, he doesn't mean it. And it takes his dad chucking a spear at him for him to be like, maybe he does want to kill him. And so when you look at this, it is, I just sort of see that you know, everything's happy. Everything's great. I'm trying to think. If you've seen the most recent Muppet movie, they sing a song. Everything is wonderful, yeah. Everything, yeah, and that's how I see Jonathan sort of like skipping around that song. I just do, man. He is an eternal optimist, even up to the end. And I think he's pragmatic, as you can see, in making the connection with David. But he wants to believe the best. And I also thought it was interesting, and I really didn't think about it until Carrie and I were talking after class. Who's doing 95% of the talking when Jonathan's around? It's Jonathan, right? It's not David. You get Jonathan, what Jonathan's saying, and then David maybe asks a couple like hypotheticals or guiding questions, and then Jonathan is just talking the rest of the time. And I think that's sort of interesting. But what we do know about Jonathan as a character is that he's very much different than his dad because what? He inquires of the Lord before he makes a decision. And we're going to see this in the slides here in a second. What is the difference we see with Saul?
Saul doesn't bother with the Lord. He doesn't even think of him as his God.
But he does, but after what? He's not looking for an answer. He's looking for confirmation, right? He's already made the decision. He just wants somebody to agree with him. And that's it. So here's a map with a lot of colorful lines on it. And these lines are going to be more obvious later. You got some names that we've seen before. We've got En-Gedi, we've got Ziv, we've got Harith. These are a bunch of the different routes we've taken to Moab's. We're going to start off where we end off the other day, up in Ramah. But who's from Gibeah? Right here. Saul, right? That's where Saul's hometown is. And then Nob is going to be a city that's going to play a lot, and we're going to look a lot of this today. But remember, the distance between Gibeah and Nob is probably what's a modern equivalent that we would use, like Smith's Grove. Like it's not far, okay? And then Gibeah to Ramah is maybe a little farther up than maybe. It's not a very far. Remember when we put Kentucky on here? Bottom of Kentucky is about right here. Top of Kentucky is up where the Jordan River, and that's like Newport to Franklin kind of thing. That slant of a line. So just remember, it's not very big. Because that's something that's always been hard for me is the geography of it. You hear, oh, they went here. Okay, how did that not take them like a week? Okay, because it's really not that far, right? If you were really dedicated to it, you could walk Smith's Grove today. You wouldn't be happy about it, probably. But maybe yep. So David's going to seek some help because Jonathan came to him. Remember, we shot the arrows. If they land in front of the rock, you're cool. They land beyond the rock, you get to step in and get out of here. And obviously they land beyond. That was something we didn't get to talk about. Jonathan takes someone with him to fetch the arrows. Why did he do that?
We use them.
Okay. But why did he take somebody with him when he knew he was going to possibly be able to meet with David? I would think plausible deniability. to be able to have somebody say, oh, no, we didn't meet with anybody. There was somebody with us. So, also, you never knew who would be just accompany you out of the castle when you're royal, not castle, out of the palace or wherever you are when you're royalty. So he takes this one kid with him, and he sends him home and gets to talk to David. He wasn't planning to talk to David, but he did get to. And that way he can say, hey, this kid was with me the whole time. I didn't talk to nobody. So, okay, so he went to Ramah in 19, and then he talked to Jonathan in 20, and then he's going to Ahimelech. As I was reading this, I was like, Abimelech. I kept saying Abimelech in my brain, and then I said, wait a second, that's an H. So Ahimelech, the priest of Nob. Okay, when you first read the priest of Nob, how many of you all were like, is Nob a god? I read this whole article where a guy was like, the priest of Nob, Nob's not a god, why does it say this? And then you're like, it's the place. Okay, he is a priest from Nob. And so that's just one of those things, when you read things on the internet, you should be like, okay, you're an idiot, I'm not going to listen to you. I'm going to read a couple verses out of it first. David answered Ahimelech, because he says, why are you here? Why are you alone? Why is no one with you? So should David have people with him?
Yes.
Probably, because he has a couple jobs, and it's interesting that he's going to list them out here in a second. So David answered Ahimelech the priest, the king sent me on a mission and said to me, no one is to know anything about the mission I am sending you on. As for my men, I have told them to meet me at this certain place. Now then, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever you can find. But the priest answered David, I don't have any ordinary bread on hand. However, there is some consecrated bread here, provided the men have kept themselves from women. David replied, indeed, women have been kept from us as usual whenever I set out. The men's bodies are holy even on missions that are not holy. How much more so today? So the priest gave him the consecrated bread, since there was no bread there except the bread of the presence that had been removed from before the Lord and replaced by hot bread on the day it was taken away. Now, one of Saul's servants, we're going to get to that here in a second. So he's going to eat the bread of the presence. Jesus talks about this in Matthew 12. Okay? Does anybody have, can you get Matthew 12 pretty quick for me? How does he cite this? Actually, it's in my history. I can just do it real quick. Okay, Matthew 12, 3 and 4. What are they talking about here?
It's talking about the disciples.
The disciples aren't washing their hands correctly. It says, have you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that the priests on Sabbath duty in the temple desecrate the Sabbath and yet are innocent? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words meant, I desire mercy, not sacrifice, you would not condemn the innocent, for the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. So he's telling him, David broke these commandments. So what's the context he's talking about here? What is Jesus trying to point us at using this story about David?
Attitude of heart over action.
Okay. So this goes back to a question I asked on Wednesday night. Did David sin by lying? Was David lying? Yeah, the first answer that I sort of came to with my part, and this is something I'm struggling with a lot lately, is it's not my job to decide if he sinned or not. That's not my job. My job is it's different to learn from it if I'm learning from it back then, but that's something we got to deal with too. It's not my job to decide if somebody else outside of this congregation sins. That's not what we're here for. We're here to seek and save the lost, not to judge and condemn. So that's number one. The second question is, I read an interesting perspective on this, that he says, the king sent me. He could have been referring to God. The God King. I can see where you can make that stretch. The real question that I think I'm seeing with is, the letter of the law versus the spirit of the law. So did David violate the letter of the law?
Yes.
He did. Did he violate the spirit of the law?
No.
Okay, because the spirit of the law is that he will become king, correct? And then if he doesn't, so there's a lot of gray, like, fuzzy areas as we talk about this, and a lot of philosophical, like, things you got to sort of work through. And it can be a little rough to sort of to process through. And this is where I think it's great. This is why I'm glad I'm teaching with Travis, is because we can sort of throw these questions back and forth at each other and be like, hey, what do you think about this? And if, like I've mentioned when I talked to class at the auditorium, if you don't have something like that, get somebody like that, that you can ask weird questions that might sound weird, but will get you where you need to be to think and just process through. Because what does Saul say to people? Come, let us, what? Our word rhymes with season.
Reason.
Come, let us reason together. Let us reason this out. Let us figure all that out. And I think that's pretty important. So, yeah, this is there's a lot of deep questions that come up, even just in these histories. So it's pretty interesting. He gets the sword of Goliath, right? He says, "I don't have any weapons." And what does the guy at Nob say? What does Ahimelech say?
I only have one. Then.
Yeah, I've got one. He said, "You've seen it before. It's the sword of Goliath. You can go get that thing if you want." So he does. It's wrapped up behind the ephod, right? And so what is before we go on? Nob is a city that is controlled by who? It's one of the priestly cities, right? And so the Levites are in control. It's one of their cities. A lot of this is hard because we want to always throw, what's the main city we want to throw back to all the time when you're looking at Old Testament stuff or even New Testament stuff? Jerusalem, right? The Jerusalem, this all should be, why is this not in Jerusalem? It's not a big place yet. It's not a central area until who makes it that?
David.
Yeah, David's going to move the palace there, he's going to build the temple there. It's just not, right? And it's sort of hard because you keep thinking, okay, why is the ephod there? Why is this here? Why is the Urim and Thummim there? Why is this? And then you're like, oh, wait, because Jerusalem's not a thing yet. And so that's one of those things, like, hopefully as we teach this, we're sort of getting out of our frame of reference of, oh, it was this. Oh, wait a second, but there was also these extra things that we know from there. So arms him physically, and he reminds him to rely on Yahweh, God. And so I want to look here. Trying to think where this is. Verse 8, he says, "Don't you have a spear, a sword here? I haven't brought my sword or any other weapons because the king's mission was urgent. The sword of Goliath, the Philistine whom you killed in the valley of Elah, is here. It is wrapped in the cloth behind the ephod. If you want it, take it. There is no sword here but that one. David said, there is none like it. Give it to me." And so he was there. Oh, by the way, in verse 7, I do want to point out, it says, "Now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's chief shepherd." And so that's one of those little asides, like if you're watching a TV show, and like the main characters are doing that thing, and all of a sudden it cuts over to like somebody like 15 feet away from behind a tree, and they're like, he's like, and then he pelts back in. That's sort of giving you that's biblical like foreshadowing for you right there. Because what do we know is going to happen? Saul's going to be told. We have to. So, and then he does that, and he goes to where?
Gath.
What's important about Gath?
It's where Goliath is from,
right? And so you think he has a lot of fans in Gath. He killed, that's like,
and
yeah, that'd be like
with
killing.
Goliath's sword.
What's that?
He showed up with Goliath's sword.
Yeah. So, and regardless, remember we talked about with Goliath that depending on the definition of a cubit, Goliath was how tall to how tall? So if the short end, he's 6'9", which regardless is still 1'4" taller than the average, the taller end of an Israelite, right? Or any modern person in then. But if you go with a more expanded version of a cubit, he's 10'6". And so that's one of those, I guess, like biblical scholar things to argue is how tall really was Goliath, and just looking at the differences in cubits and who would call this kind of cubit or that kind of cubit. It's one of the reasons we think Napoleon is short, because the French foot was shorter. And so, sort of the same ideas. But regardless, the sort of six, if you've ever done any kind of, like, weapons training, it is the size of the weapon matters, right? Me, as a 260-pound guy, would use a much larger, like, weapon, or I could swing a much larger weapon because of the balance and the weight and everything. David being, let's just say he's full grown at this point, 5'5" at the top end versus 6'9" at the low end, average it out 7-foot-something, 8-foot-something, would be completely different. And so some see this as a miraculous thing that he could actually wield the sword, but it's sort of reading into things. So he goes to Gath, and what does he do? This is going to be a pretty quick one. He shows up, and what does King Achish say?
Is this not David?
Yeah. Don't they sing about this man? Yeah. And so that's interesting. I find it interesting that others are starting to recognize that he's the king. So when did that start spreading is a question that I have. Like, when do others start to say, this is David the king, but there's also Saul the king, so where do we go? Yeah, what do you say? Come into this, because there's a lot of, like, because if he is king, does Achish want to build a thing with him? Because Achish would probably know that he's living in a city that is supposed to be controlled by these people, and so there is a lot. The question about why is Goliath's sword with the priests? What was the practice that we saw with the Ark of the Covenant? What did they do with it when they captured it early on?
They took it to their God's temple.
Yes, and so do we really remember that the Israelites sort of co-opt a lot of different things from other people around them? They would take spoils from fights and battles and put them in the temple as well, as a practice sort of akin to that. Not the same as taking their gods, but that's where I would think that the big sword would show up there. So he acts insane in verses 10 to 15. So he pretended to be, this is in verse 13, so he pretended to be insane in the presence of, and while he was in their hands, and he acted like a madman, making marks on the door of the gate and letting saliva run down his beard. Achish said to his servants, "Look at the man. He is insane. Why bring him to me? Am I so short of madmen that you have to bring this fellow here to carry on like this in front of me? Must the man come into my house?"
Sounds like he has rabies.
Yeah. So he's making himself sound insane. But there's actually some interesting historical context here that Achish was sort of known to have a lot of mad people, crazy people. There are some records there that talk about how many mentally disturbed people would show up there. People have gone so far as to make claims, not claims, but like hypotheses about possibly the way the region was. Their water might have been contaminated, metals, stuff like that. But it's just interesting that you sort of get this, I got enough madmen. I'm go sell crazy somewhere else. We're all stocked up here. And so, and what's interesting, the question, must this man come into my house? Why does he ask that? And it goes back to what he said when he first sees him.
Because he's king.
He's king. It would be the polite, hospitable thing to bring people in. Because say what you want about pagan cultures, what do they honor more than anything? The laws of what?
Hospitality.
Right? And that is that's a major thing, right? And we don't really have that because we have, like, the invention of the car sort of did away with a lot of the hospitality stuff where you don't have overnight travel more often than not, you get where you're going in one day, right? Or you find a hotel. But even if you go back to the late 1800s, 1700s, that law of somebody shows up, you put them up, right? If you meet a traveler, you'd invite them, hey, come stay at our house, we're good to go. Or, hey, there's an inn up this far. We'll get you this far if you need it to. So there's a lot there. So let me keep going. So he's going to go to Adullam. Let me get here in a second. And um, So now we're up into 22, okay? And this is David at Adullam, and that's hard to say, Adullam. Like, I don't feel like I'm saying it right, but... And Mizpah. So in verse 1 of chapter 22, it says, David left Gath and escaped to the cave of Adullam. When his brothers and his father's household heard about it, they went down to him there. All those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him, and he became their commander. About 400 men were with him. So what were they in debt, discontented, and in distress? About what?
Because of Saul.
Yeah. I think we can read that into that distress or discontented. And he becomes their commander, which is interesting because his brothers are there, right? And was David sort of still deferring to his brothers, or at least acting like he was deferring to his brothers? Because what was the excuse to go for him to get away from Saul the first time?
Had to go see his family.
I'm going to go see my family to do sacrifices because who commanded it? His brother, right? So he's still, I still think there's an interesting play going on there where he is still not subject to his brothers, but he is still respecting their elderness over him. Just a little aside. Okay, so they're at the cave, and then from there, David went to Mizpah. I think I've got a map somewhere. Let me go back to my map real quick, because I'm going to show you that real quick. So the cave of Adullam, and then he goes to Mizpah, which is down here on the other side of the Dead Sea. By the way, if you want to see an interesting effect of change over time, the Dead Sea, by the way, I always thought it looked like a manatee, personally. Anybody see the manatee? You know, you see nothing but the manatee. The Dead Sea now is about that big. About that big. Because the Jordanians and the Israelites and Israelis always fight over the water. And one of the big issues is when they redirect the water flow, which you have to grow crops there, the Dead Sea is slowly drying up. And even just over the last 50 years that we've had satellite imagery, it's neat because that's one of the things they use as an identifying mark. You know, you have survey marks. When you do satellite imagery, that's one of the things they use. Oh, there's the Dead Sea. But it's really interesting if you look that up. So, I think it's going to give us some Adullam all the way down to Mizpah. Why does he go all the way over there?
Get as far away from Saul as possible.
Yeah, and also, not only that...
protect his parents.
What's that?
To protect his parents.
Protect his parents. But Moab is a fairly powerful entity at this point. And
Saul actually attacked them.
Correct. And so does Saul have any friends in the Moabites? Probably not. Yeah. So once again, we're going to see the politics come into play there, where he's going to take advantage of that. And so he's gone out. He's seeking help. Verse 5, but the prophet of Gad said to David, do not stay in the stronghold. Go into the land of Judah. So David left and went to the fortress of Hereth, which is going to be back in the land of Judah. Once again, David's showing that what? Even though it doesn't make sense, he's going to do what? He's going to listen to the prophet, right? Because the prophet Gad told him to do this, right? But he does ask for protection. The king of Moab stayed with him as long as David was in the stronghold. So the question is, do the parents stay and he leaves? Or do the parents go with him when he leaves?
He specifically asked for his parents to stay.
Yeah, but it says he left them to the king of Moab, and they stayed with him as long as David was in the stronghold. Some people read that two ways. They stayed with him, David, as long as in the stronghold, and stayed when he left. Or they stayed with him, the king, when the king was in the stronghold. There's a whole bunch of different ways. I believe they stayed. It's just... it makes a little more sense when we get to some other things. Now, this is the next one. So, Ahimelech inquiring of God on David's behalf was seen as treasonous. So, the story here is what happened. Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered, and Saul was seated. And I love this little aside that they throw in here, right? Spear in hand under the tamarisk tree on a hill at Gibeah with all his officials standing at his side. The spear in hand thing sort of throws me off because when do they also explain that he has spear in his hand?
Not the probe.
When he chucked it at David and when he chucked it at at Jonathan. Both of them said, sitting the spear in hand. I think that's a poetic way to explain that Saul is not happy. I think that's a way the author is telling us, giving us a little symbology, a little repetition into Saul's frame of mind when things are happening. So, and what he says to them, he said to them, verse 7, "Listen, men of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse," once again, what is he not using?
His name.
David's name, yeah. "Give you all of your fields and vineyards? Will he make all of you commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? Is that why you all will conspire against me? No one tells me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. None of you is concerned about me or tells me that my son has incited the servants to lie in wait for me as he does today." What is he saying?
He's saying Jonathan's committing treason.
He said, okay, Jonathan's committing treason, but he's accusing them all of what? Taking bribes. That's what he's saying here. Is the son of Jesse going to give you a vineyard? Is he going to make you a commander? Is he giving you all this stuff? Is that why y'all are treating me like this? And he has a spear in his hand, so I'm just waiting for one of them to be like, they're looking over at each other like, who's going to say something first? Because this spear is probably going to get hurled at that person. You're not telling me this. To me, it sounds whiny.
Oh,
you're not telling me. You're not doing this.
He is crazy, though.
Yeah, I think that's as you go through it, you sort of see it again. But Doeg the Edomite, right? We're flashing back again.
Yeah.
Like in a TV show, it would start playing like a dun dun dun. He sort of steps out from the crowd. He's like, "Hold on a second, guys." But Doeg the Edomite, who was standing in the Saul's officials, said, "I saw the son of Jesse come to Ahimelech, son of Atub at Nob. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him, and he also gave him provisions and a sword of Goliath the Philistine. Then the king sent for the priest Ahimelech, son of Atub, and all the men of his family who were priests of Nob, and they all came to the king. Saul said, 'Listen now, son of Atub.'" Once again, he's not doing what? Not using his name. That would have been the equivalent of his last name, by the way, son of Atub. That's what his title, sort of. He said, "Yes, my lord." Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me? You were the son of you and the son of Jesse, giving him bread and sword, inquiring of God for him, so that he has rebelled against me and lies in wait for me as he does today." And Ahimelech answered the king, and what's he going to tell him?
Told him what David had told him.
Yeah, and he's going to sort of say what Jonathan said earlier, right? He's going to preface what he tells him with a little history lesson.
David's a good guy.
It said, "Who of all your servants is as loyal as David, the king's son-in-law? Your son-in-law, captain of your bodyguard, and highly respected in your household?" It's like, who wouldn't be respected? He's a powerful man. It's almost to where Jonathan said, "He hadn't done anything to you. Why are you trying to kill him?" Right? And sort of throws that history lesson at him. What was the day the first time I inquired of God for him? Of course not. Or was this day the first time? Let the king accuse your servant or any of his family of your servant. Your servant knows nothing at all about this whole affair. But the king said, "You will surely die, Ahimelech, you and your whole family." And the king ordered the guards at his side to do what? Kill him. But what they say?
No.
And then the king looked at Doeg. "You turn and strike down the priest." So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck them down the day he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. So 85 priests. He also put the sword to Nob, the town of the priest, with its men, its children, infants, its cattle, donkeys, and sheep. So they can totally destroy a whole town now when it serves Saul's ideas. But before, when God had told them specifically what to do, what'd they do?
They saved the good stuff.
Yeah, they kept the good stuff. But one son of Ahimelech, Hattub, named Abathar, escaped and fled to David. He told David that Saul had killed the priest of the Lord. Then David said to Abathar, "That day when Doeg the Edomite was there, I knew he would do that. Be sure to tell Saul I am responsible for the death of your whole family." Or to tell Saul, "I am responsible for the death of your whole family. Stay with me. Don't be afraid. The man who wants to kill you is trying to kill me too. You will be safe with me." He says, "This is my fault. I'm sorry. Stay with me," and in the Hebrew, that is more than just stay with me. That is, attach yourself to me. Stick around, like, make a covenant and stick with me, because I'll protect you. And that's important. That's a big deal. Yeah.
Well, that was interesting. The guards, who I assume were Israelites, they said, "We're not going to kill the priest." And he looks at the Edomite.
Yeah.
Like, you do it.
He's got to get a different person. And so that's interesting. Yeah.
Before you go on, sorry, I did want to interrupt earlier. When you were talking about with Saul with the spear in hand, And then later it says that he lies in wait against me. That to me just shows how paranoid Saul is.
Yeah.
He always has his spear in his hand, and David is lying in wait for me, and it's your fault.
Yeah, there's
like,
somebody.
He's
yeah.
just paranoid.
Yeah, and there is that that paranoia is obvious as we see it, and sort of as I read this, I keep seeing a slow degradation of Saul's mental state. It gets worse and worse and worse as
yeah.
we go. And like he literally just had a whole town burned down because a guy did something he'd done several times before. So the question is, like another question that comes up, David lies to Ahimelech.
Mm-hmm.
Ahimelech then acts upon that lie. Is Ahimelech guilty? Of anything? Is he guilty of treason though? Against the king. He was acting against the king though.
But it's no, the king's son-in-law, that's usually someone of power. If the son-in-law says, I'm doing this for the king, he's like, okay, yeah, I'm going to help you. If I go against you, then I'm committing treason.
Yeah, and so that's always a question that comes about when you hear about false teachers. If a false teacher tells you something, lies to you, and you act on it, is that sin? Because that's one of the connections a couple of the commentators make here. Is this is one of those other fuzzy furry areas, right? But as soon as he knows what David was lying or was incorrect, what does he say? Does he make excuses or justifications? He makes a justification, but he makes it correct. It's not an excuse. I think the difference between excuses you're trying to get out of it. Justification means I'm doing this because of this. Why wouldn't I? Beforehand, and I think that you get some interesting questions that come out of all this, just in the way that lies and truth and half truths, and how do you make all that jive with the way that it's rolling. So, the slaughter of the priest at Nob. This is one of those images that so he would be there. Killing these people. Now, did Doeg the Edomite kill all 85 himself? Most likely not. Okay. Most of the time when you hear about an official, it's sort of like when you hear about like the Secretary of State. Oh, the Secretary of State did this. No, there's like 1,700 people that work under him. And then there's about 1,000 or each of them. Most of the time, for instance, when it talks about, well, Abraham did this, it's Abraham and his family. Or Saul or David or Solomon did this. It's their people that sort of work with him too. Because he's the chief shepherd. He would have a whole clan that would be working with him too. Would the place probably look like this? Probably not. This is probably about 200-300 years in the future where you're going to see temples that look like this. Maybe David's temple will look this nice, but it is the one building that will look this nice. The rest of them are a little more, I would say, rustic, to be polite. But yeah, they would go in and remember what we said about the word slaughter?
Throat slitting,
specifically, because it's in reference to how you would kill an animal. And it was seen as extremely disrespectful to an enemy to slaughter them, to slit their throat, because they would. It's symbolic of how you kill an animal, so you mean less to me than an animal. All that good stuff. So, whew. So, back to the 1 Samuel 2:31 through 36. So he does. What was his promise to the house of Israel? To the house of Eli?
You're going to be cut off. Your servant, your descendants are going to be begging for a position.
Okay.
Just so that they can eat.
Okay. So Hophni and Phinehas get killed in the battle, right? And then what happened to Eli? Yeah, it was a freak accident. He fell off. He fell off his stool, right? And did what?
Okay.
Broke his neck because he was had great weight. He was, as Davis would say, he's a fatty boombalati. And he falls, busts his neck open. 85 priests of Eli's lineage are killed in Dob. These are descendants of Eli, if not direct family members. You know, descendants means a little farther off. Probably even closer than that, right? Grandchildren. But Abathar survived at Doeg and serves as priest until 1 Kings, when he's removed from service, right? So Eli is told that his family is going to be cut off from the priesthood, right? And it happens. So this is a fulfillment of that prophecy from much, much earlier. And you know the good thing about teaching three classes in a row is I can just pick this up when I do on Wednesday. So Abathar, he takes personal responsibility for that, or David takes responsibility for that slaughter, because why? Did he do it?
No, it's just his character.
It is his character, yeah, and that's an important thing. How would have Saul reacted? Let's say roles were reversed. Saul is in this role.
He would have made excuses.
He'd have blamed David.
He'd have blamed anybody.
It wasn't my fault. David is the one that's crazy.
Yeah, you made me do this, right? Classic abuser technology or work. You're making me do it. You made me do it. But David, on the other hand, has a true leader's heart, and he says what?
It's my fault.
He says, I did this. He said, my actions brought this apart, which shows something interesting about David, that he understands that his actions have repercussions. And a lot of leadership, people don't understand that. It may not be that you did this, but step, you've set that boulder rolling down the hill. And I think that this affects who he is, and we're going to see that in the next chapter. So he brings the ephod with him. Most people think this is the real, like, so ephod is just a priestly vestment, but there's a difference between an ephod and the ephod, right? And this would be it. Has a stone for each of the tribes, right? And they wear it sort of like, this one just cracks me up because it looks sort of flowery, like an apron you would see on Leave It to Beaver or something. But it would be multiple colored. It would have the stones for each one. In that stone was the pouch of the Urim and the Thurim, where they would draw in the black or the white stone. So what's interesting, though, is also you have priest-elect Abathar, right? Because the other priests are all dead. Ahimelech, the high priest, is dead, right? And then king-elect David. So what does this sort of symbolize?
The kingdom being established.
Yeah. But not just that, you have the physical king and the physical leader, like the political leader, and you have the spiritual leader / guide sort of smushed all together. Yeah.
Well, one of the things I found interesting with Abathar bringing the ephod with him,
mm-hmm.
this means that David is still able to inquire of God whenever
correct.
He needs
yep.
to.
And that who can't?
Saul.
Yeah, Saul can't do that anymore, which is interesting. So
I also think it's interesting that he's able to find David. Like, he knows where to look for him.
Yeah. Well, but you also remember when David went to that cave and his brothers and his family, the whole family hears it, and 400 people show up. It's sort of like, how many of y'all work with somebody, if you want something to get out, you tell that one person and everybody tells it, right? I've got students like that. If I want people to know that X needs to happen, I just go tell that one kid. I'm like, hey, but don't tell anybody. by the next day, everybody has it. So Keilah, Saul orders result in the struggle, not based on paranoia, just anger, yeah. So David asks God for guidance, right? And he says, when David was told, look, the Philistines are fighting against Keilah and looting and the threshing floors, he inquired the Lord, saying, shall I go attack these Philistines? The Lord answered him and said, go attack the Philistines and save Keilah. But David's men said to him, here in Judah we are afraid. How much more then if we go to Keilah against the Philistine forces? Once again, David inquired of the Lord. What did the Lord say again? Go. And so, and it's interesting, it's just real simple. So David and his men went to Keilah, fought the Philistines, carried off their livestock, he inflicted heavy losses on the Philistines, and saved the people of Keilah. Now Abathar, son of Ahimelech, was brought the ephod down with him, and when he fled to David at Keilah. So it's just a little aside there. How many of y'all have verse 6 is in brackets, yeah. It is, because it's sort of like an aside, just in case you were wondering how he was admiring God, he brought this with him. So Saul is just going to leave him alone, right? Let him protect and get even more protection, right? He's going to be like, oh, man, that's cool. He's doing good stuff. No, he says, God has delivered him into my hands, for David has imprisoned himself by entering a town with gates and bars. And Saul called up all his forces from battle to go down to Keilah to besiege David with his men. And he said, in verse 9 says, bring the ephod. And when David said, Lord God of Israel, your servant has heard definitely that Saul plans to come to Keilah and destroy this town on account of me, will the citizens of Keilah surrender me to him? Will Saul come down as your servant has heard? Lord God of Israel, tell your servant. And the Lord said, he will. And David said, will the citizens of Keilah surrender me and my men to Saul? They will. And so David and his men, about 600 in number, left Keilah, kept moving from place to place to place. When Saul was told that David had escaped Keilah, he did not go there. What do you think is going through Saul's, David's mind with this?